ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, could I have your attention, please? Thank you, and welcome to this lunch of the South Australian Press Club, at which our guest is the Chief Justice, John Doyle. My name's Terry Plain. I'm the News Director at Channel 7. I'm deputising today for Megan Lloyd, who I'm told is in the Caribbean sunning herself. She's obviously in a better place than we are. A few acknowledgements first. I'd like to acknowledge our sponsor representatives, Phil Catley from Telstra, Jeff Timms, Timms Manufacturing Jewellers, Stephen Wade, Shadow Attorney General. There are representatives here as well from the Police, Corrections Department, Crown Solicitors, Victim Support Service and the Law Society, and along with working journalists and, of course, some non-working journalists, we welcome them all. We'll hear from the Chief Justice after our main course. I'd especially like to acknowledge Telstra as the principal sponsor of the Press Club lunches, and today we'll drink wines from Jacobs Creek and beer from SA Brewing. There are raffle tickets on the table, which I'd urge you to support, and there will be prizes from Jeff Timms Manufacturing and beer and wine from SA Brewing. I trust you enjoy your lunch today. I'll be back a little later to introduce the Chief Justice. Thank you. Excuse me. Excuse me. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to interrupt if you're still eating. I hope you've enjoyed the main course. I'd like to welcome the Chief Justice to this den. We usually see him and his colleagues in their, what can sometimes appear to be secret society with their strange garb and hairpieces and so forth. There are areas where the law sometimes rubs up against what we try to do in media. Adelaide's been through periods where it's been dubbed Suppression City, and that's often a frustration to working media. More recently, I think there's been a clear conflict between the way the law deals with conventional media and the new online and social media, and there's a long-running debate on whether or not cameras should be allowed in courts. Obviously, coming from a television background, I'm a great advocate for cameras in courts, but I know there are differing opinions on that. John Doyle is obviously an eminent jurist. You don't get to the sort of position he's in without being such. He was educated at St Ignatius College in Adelaide, was dux of that school in 1962, graduated in law from the University of Adelaide in 1966, was a Rhodes Scholar in 1967, and completed studies in law at Magdalen at Oxford in 69. In 1970, he was admitted to the bar. He was appointed Chief Justice in 1995 after serving as Solicitor General in South Australia, where he was highly regarded for his skills as an advocate, particularly in complex constitutional cases. Prior to that, he was a partner at Kelly & Co and was a founding member at Hanson Chambers. He's had a fabulous career in the law, and I ask you to welcome the Chief Justice of South Australia, John Doyle.
Celebrating my arrival, was it? thank you, Terry. I felt a bit alarmed when I heard that people, representatives here from the police, the Crown Solicitor and Correctional Services. I thought, they've got me all stitched up. It's going to be arrest, prosecution and take me away straight away. I thought I'd talk today about three loosely related topics. The first of them is the impact of information technology on some aspects of the work of the courts. The second is the problem of increasing complexity in the law. And the third, some aspects of what we call problem-solving courts. I'm happy to answer questions about any of these matters and, in fact, about anything related to the administration of justice on which it's appropriate for me to comment. Information technology is so pervasive and its effects spread so far and so fast that it's easy to overlook its capacity to transform our environment, including our professional working environment. The changes in the modes and speed of the transmission of information in my time in the law have been extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. And I actually think the pace of change is increasing. We need to be aware that these changes that result from advances in information technology require us and require all lawyers to be alert to what I call the transformative effect of information technology advances. There are two things I'd single out. The ability of individuals to disseminate information very widely in a manner which in the past could be achieved only by the media. And second, the ability of individuals and the media to transmit information far more quickly than could ever have been done in the past. Taken together, these two are potent influences on the work of the courts. There is a tendency to think that what's happening in our time has never been experienced before. That's not so. The invention of the printing press absolutely transformed life in early modern Europe. Closer to our time, I suspect that when the use of the telephone first became widespread, it also had a similar transformative effect. I remember reading about an English senior English public servant who, when telephones were coming in, said in horror, "Does that mean that someone can ring me at any time?" And just again, that idea, well, for the first time in his life, that could happen. The photocopy, which came in the early 70s, has also really transformed our society. So these transformative things have happened in the past, but there's no doubt we're going through a phase in which information technology advances are having a dramatic effect on our society, on our economy and on our professions. As you know, we have a regime of statutory prohibitions coupled with the power given to courts to make suppression orders, and there are the two things. Although the public often don't realise it, sometimes it's a statutory prohibition, sometimes it's a suppression order. And together they limit the ability of the media and others to publish certain details of court proceedings. It's all in the Evidence Act. These statutory prohibitions and suppression orders prohibit the publication of certain material. The prohibition has been understood to mean a prohibition on the dissemination of material to a substantial part of the public. Although, again, a lot of people don't realise it, the legislative regime doesn't prohibit the public from being present in court, doesn't prohibit them from hearing what is said, obviously, or even from going home and talking to their spouse or partner about what they heard and saw in court. What is prohibited is dissemination of material to a substantial part of the public. That regime was enacted at a time when it seemed enough to control the publication of material by the media, radio, television, and the print media. That was how the general public learned about what was happening in court. The system was able to cope with the few individuals who published prohibited information. In part, the system could cope because their ability to do that was very limited. Today's information technology was not available to them, and only the media could reach a substantial part of the public. The media knew the rules and by and large observed them, even though their opposition to the system is well known. The system worked, meaning it did prevent the general publication of prohibited material, at least in this state. Information technology has transformed the environment in which the Evidence Act operates, and it's undermining the basis of the regime. It's doing so because individuals now can transmit information before anything can be done to stop them, and they're able to transmit that information far and wide. So the technology has enabled them to do something they simply couldn't do in the past. So the existing regime is being outflanked by changes in information technology. Well, is this a good thing or a bad thing? I know a number of you here will think it's a good thing. But we need to bear in mind that if the existing regime does collapse, there will be a cost to the administration of justice and to the public interest. There will be some trials that will be aborted because of the publication of information that makes a fair trial impossible. Some individuals will suffer unfairly because they won't get the benefit of the statutory protection. Some witnesses may be reluctant to give evidence because their identity can't be protected, and some victims will be reluctant to report offences. Now, there's no point wringing our hands about what's happening now. It's impossible to turn the clock back. The question for the courts and for the government is, I think, what happens next? And it's mainly a question for the government. I doubt whether the existing regime can be maintained by prosecuting Twitterers, tweeters and others. I don't actually know, but I suspect that there are far too many of them for this to be practical. Also, if the information is coming from a source outside the state, it won't be practical to prosecute those sources. I doubt whether the prosecution of some selected individuals is going to deter others. I think if that was done, the media, many of you here, would mount a massive campaign in their support, and I doubt whether any Australian government would have much appetite for prosecutions on that basis. So that does leave us with the underlying issue of policy. How should we respond? What are the possible responses? One, as I mentioned, would be a vigorous program of prosecution, and I don't think that's viable. I've said that. Another would be to have heavier penalties in the hope that deters people. At present, breach of a suppression order attracts a maximum punishment of a fine of $10,000 or 2 years' imprisonment. For a body corporate, the maximum fine is $120,000. I myself doubt whether increasing the penalties will work. In other words, I don't think increasing the penalties will scare people off. Maybe some technological solution will emerge, although I don't really see how it could, some system of blocking offending transmissions through the internet. I'm confident no such solution is going to emerge in my time. Another option is simply, and this is what's really happening at the moment, to sit tight and see what happens. The problem is that doing that means that cases involving some prominent people, cases involving sensitive information, won't get the protection which I think most people would agree they deserve. I don't mean you'd agree with us in every case, but I think everyone would agree there are some cases where protection is appropriate. So at the moment, I think in fact we are sitting tight, even though I recognise that is not in any sense a long-term answer. A related problem is that of vilification of people charged, coupled with the publication of prejudicial information about them. This has potential to result in harm to individuals charged, particularly from vigilantes, as a result of them being identified and their addresses being disclosed. That's to say nothing about the impact on the obligation of the court to provide a fair trial. I think we may well have difficulty providing a fair trial from time to time until a satisfactory response to the situation is identified. It's ironic that News Limited in particular, which has launched a campaign against the use of suppression orders, can now, I think, in a sense, rest on the oars. I think the technology may be doing the job for them. It's a very difficult policy issue for the government, and it's a real problem for the courts. I don't mean right now, but as I said, we are, in a sense, sitting tight, and I think you'd all appreciate that sitting tight isn't a particularly productive option. Before I leave that topic, I just want to say something briefly about Twitterers and tweeters in court. My children would say I'm an absolute imposter. I have a mobile phone that I use about once a month. I'm almost totally computer illiterate, and I'm throwing these terms around as if I know exactly what they mean. I think I know what they mean, but don't ask me. I'm talking about people who are using mobile phones and other devices in the courtroom to transmit information about what is happening contemporaneously in the courtroom. As far as I'm aware, this hasn't yet surfaced as a major problem in South Australia, but the technology is there now, as you all know. The English courts have distributed an interesting issues paper raising all the issues, I think, that this technology poses and raising possible ways of grappling with it. I've decided to await the outcome of the English inquiry before doing anything here. I see no need for us to cover the same ground. It was an excellent position paper, and I'm sure that the responses to it will be very informative. But I just want to mention two aspects of this phenomenon that are worth considering. First of all, it's not uncommon for an application for a suppression order to be made a few minutes or even more than that after the evidence is given, because the significance of the evidence can take a little while to sink in. If someone in court is twittering and tweeting away, the information might have gone by the time anyone gets an opportunity to consider an application for a suppression order. Second, I've got no doubt that twittering and tweeting could be used as a none too subtle means of intimidating a witness. It could be used to create the impression for the witness that someone, possibly someone they've been told about, is watching what the witness says. It could also be used to relay to another person outside the courtroom information about how the present witness's evidence is progressing, e.g. to the next witness to be called. So there are a number of these issues that, again, need consideration, and they're not going to be easy to resolve. I turn now to television cameras in court, a matter which surfaces from time to time, although lately things have been a bit quiet. I know that the electronic media, television channels mainly, want to be able to film court proceedings and to use clips from the proceedings. And I realise that a clip from in court is much better as backing for a news story than a shot of the presenter standing outside the court speaking to the camera or doing the usual chase along the side of Victoria Square and then down Googer Street. You get to know some of the journos, and I feel a bit sorry, at least for the cameramen, when I see them running, carrying those cameras. One day someone's going to have a very nasty fall, and there'll be a lot of people who won't be very sympathetic. So far, the courts have refused to allow this, that is, cameras in court, on a regular basis, although on some occasions it has been permitted here and in other states. My own attitude is that it's the public interest that is the key here. It will be in the public interest to allow the public to see film of court proceedings if this will improve public understanding of the court process. On the other hand, there's no public interest, in my opinion, in a 20 or 30 second clip of vision to back up a standard television news item, because the public don't learn anything from that about the court process. If television channels were willing to broadcast substantial parts of a court hearing, and I mean minutes, or not even just minutes, perhaps half an hour, perhaps an hour, perhaps with the use of a voiceover or text on screen to explain what is happening. For instance, the voiceover might say, Ms X is currently being cross-examined by counsel for the defence, that sort of thing that I don't know if they still do it, but they used to do it with parliamentary broadcasts. That sort of thing, if it were to happen, might warrant the courts making an effort to make it possible. I want to emphasise that allowing cameras in court does require considerable effort by the judge, court staff, prosecution and sometimes the defence, if we're talking of the criminal law. If particular proceedings are to be filmed, the judge has to consider and then rule on any objection by the prosecution or defence, or in a civil case, plaintiff or defence. And obviously that has to be done in advance of the trial starting. The judge may have to consider a request by a particular witness or witnesses not to be filmed. Any other complications from filming that might arise need to be considered, such as, e.g., protecting the identity of undercover police officers. And all these things have to be attended to before the trial begins, and then someone has to keep an eye on what's being published. New Zealand presently allows cameras in court and has fairly detailed rules about what can and cannot be filmed and how the material can be used. For instance, the accused can only be filmed at certain stages of the trial. I know from talking to the New Zealand judges informally that this does amount to a significant, or this is a significant amount of pre-trial work for the judge. My informal inquiries suggest that by and large the material in New Zealand is only being used on news clips, and as I said, in my opinion, there's no public benefit in that. The input required from judges and others isn't warranted. So at present I remain unpersuaded that the court should make the effort required to allow television cameras in court. The Victorian Bushfire Royal Commission streamed its proceedings live to the web. The picture wasn't high quality, but I understand that the cost wasn't great. Those proceedings weren't as complex an event as a trial, but based on the Victorian experience, my own preference for what it's worth is for the court itself to stream cases to the web with an explanatory voiceover or text on the screen. In this way, we could ensure that the public would be able to see the complete proceedings. I certainly wouldn't limit the streaming to criminal cases. Indeed, my aim would be to stream a mix of civil and criminal cases, appellate and trial. I think doing this, if we can manage the technology and if we can afford it, would be worthwhile the court setting it up, because it would let the public, those who are interested, see a whole case or at least substantial chunks of a case if they chose to watch. My hope is that in a few years that will come to pass. At this stage, we're thinking about it only in a very preliminary way, and the idea could proceed only if we get funding from the government. But even this has some complications that need to be addressed. I'm sure the technology will improve, but we'd need to think about the amount of explanatory material that's provided while proceedings are running. There's also the question of what cases are to be streamed. While I anticipate, at least in my vision of it, that the court would retain control, I wouldn't want it to be thought that the choice of cases reflected some agenda being run by the court, and we would need to think about how that was managed. And we'd also need to consider how we would handle requests by the media then to take clips from that material. So I think in a way the debate about cameras in court will also be overtaken by advances in technology. The fact that courts can now without great difficulty stream material to the web means that courts can take charge of the process and do it themselves. And the fact that courts are moving to modes of recording their proceedings for their own purposes that involve sound and vision means, again, that it's getting much easier for the material to be made available to the public without the media having to bring their cameras into court. So there's another example there, I think, of technology outflanking our current thinking. I just want to turn to a more general aspect of information technology. We now have the technology that enables us to create the virtual courtroom. The judge could be in one place with a screen. Counsel could be in their offices with a screen. The witness could be in yet another place with a screen. I put aside the issue of the jury for the moment. In other words, instead of assembling in a building and in a particular room in that building, the parties could deal with the proceedings entirely on screen from different locations. Now that that has become possible, I'm sure there will be pressure on courts to use the virtual courtroom. Arguments will be based on the convenience of witnesses, on the efficiency of breaking the proceedings up perhaps into small blocks, dealt with at times convenient to everyone involved, rather than going to a central building, to a room in that building, and then starting one day and running until the case finishes. I think if this occurs, it's going to transform the role of barristers. Our system is very heavily based on confrontation in the courtroom between witnesses and between lawyers with the judge as an observer, and it's based very heavily on orality, by which I mean evidence and arguments given orally. The judge's observation of witnesses in the flesh is also an important part of many cases. All of this can happen on screen, and I've no doubt that doing it on the screen through a virtual courtroom would affect in quite fundamental ways the manner in which proceedings are conducted and the manner in which barristers operate. It would also impact on public and media scrutiny. Many witnesses and other participants would much prefer to give evidence from a remote location on the screen because it would mean the media simply couldn't get at them to film them. And also, if this happens, you wonder, well, if the media want to watch, where do they go? Do they go to a room where there's six screens on the wall and simply sit there? Or then do we take the next step and give them a connection so that they can sit in the newsroom and watch the screens? So, again, this technology has the potential for a very transformative effect. The possibility has a particular relevance to appeals, which is something that I think some people haven't noticed yet. At present, when we hear an appeal, we're to some extent limited in our ability to reverse findings of fact if they rest on the assessment by the trial judge or trial magistrate of the demeanour or appearance of a witness. Because on appeal, we can't see the witness. We can read what the witness said, but we can't see the witness. And if the judge says the witness gave the evidence in a most unconvincing manner, well, then that's very hard to get around because that's the impression the judge made at the time. If all of the proceedings are recorded electronically, an appeal court will be in as good a position as a trial judge to decide issues based on demeanour and credit. The appeal court will be able to see and hear the witnesses for itself, and that's going to require a consideration of this aspect of the role of appellate courts once the traditional advantage of a trial judge no longer exists. Personally, the last thing I think we want is for an appeal to become a rerun of the trial with all of the evidence being scrutinised afresh. And so that's another challenge that faces our system due to advances in IT. We're going to be challenged to do things differently simply because information technology makes that possible and for no other reason. In other words, the argument won't be what you're doing now isn't good enough, it needs to be improved. The argument will be we can do things differently, so why aren't you doing things differently? And it can be very difficult to resist that line of argument at times. So I think this is an illustration of the more general issues or challenges from IT. I want to say something now about problem-solving courts. I mean courts like the drug court, the Aboriginal court, the domestic violence court. In the higher courts, when we sentence a drug user, for example, we use the sentence as best we can as a means of encouraging change and as a means of encouraging the offender to stop abusing illicit drugs and to rehabilitate himself or herself. A sentence is a very blunt and undiscriminating way of doing that. But that's the best we can do. We don't actually try to treat people. In the drug court, the court is used as the focus for treatment, with the court supervising the administration of that treatment. Over a period of time, the offender, assisted by professionals, is helped to grapple with the underlying addiction. The court tries to solve the problem that leads to the offence, not merely punish. This approach has had considerable success, and it's an approach that's capable of much wider application. It could be used, for example, in cases where the issue is abuse of alcohol. It could be used where the underlying problem is violence by young males. But problem-solving courts are fairly costly because they rely on a fairly costly court system to administer what is, in the end, treatment and can be administered in more traditional ways. But the evidence suggests that for certain categories of offenders, and I emphasise certain categories, this system does get better results than the traditional punishment approach. I expect there's going to be pressure to expand the treatment or therapeutic role of courts, as it's sometimes called, but this requires some caution. Judges and magistrates aren't trained for this and have to be trained if they're to do it properly. A treatment court operates in a manner not compatible with our normal method of court proceedings, and it is a relatively expensive way of treating a problem. Treatment courts or problem-solving courts aren't a panacea. They offer prospects of improved outcomes, but need to be deployed with considerable care. I support what the Magistrates Court in this state has done and is doing, and I've noted the arguments for expanding treatment courts to sentencing more generally. I do agree that the existing traditional approach to sentencing has limited prospects of success in relation to certain categories of offender, and that treatment courts may work better. I suspect that every judge has had the experience of wishing that instead of delivering formal sentencing remarks, he or she could sit down with the offender and say, "Now, look here, do you realise?" and talk to them, but the system doesn't allow us to do that. So all I can say is my own approach is one of cautious acceptance of the underlying merit of expanding treatment courts. The final thing I want to talk about relatively briefly is the issue of complexity in the law. The law, particularly statute law, has certainly become more complex in my time, even though for much of this time there's been a refrain of "let's simplify the law." I don't think we've achieved simplification. There are a number of factors at work. First of all, parliaments, and especially the Commonwealth Parliament, tend to enact more complex legislation and longer legislation. Parliament often enacts measures of a social nature that can be enforced by individuals making a claim for damages. These statutory claims are usually made available concurrently with common law claims and sometimes along with other statutory remedies. What we find these days is that the trial judge in a civil case often has to consider a long list of alternative claims and remedies based on common law, state legislation and Commonwealth legislation. And so civil cases are actually tending to become more complicated than they were when I was a young practitioner. There's just no doubt about that, and they're much more complicated. The criminal law has also become more complicated. Under the banner of being tough on crime, governments here and elsewhere have promoted legislation to create new offences with additional penalties, usually attached to gradations of the offence that reflect degrees of seriousness. So now we have crimes such as aggravated serious criminal trespass, and both aggravated and serious, you have to drill down into them to understand what they mean. The additional elements of aggravated and serious all have to be explained to a jury and then applied by a judge in sentencing. In the 60s and 70s, we went through an era in which a lot of old statutory provisions enacted to deal with specific problems were repealed. So there was legislation about setting fire to haystacks, legislation about obstructing wharves. Nearly all of this legislation could be traced back to the time when trade unions were establishing the right to fight for better conditions for their workers, but they stayed on the statute book probably for another 100 years. So in the 60s and 70s, we went through the statute books. When I say we, I mean the law generally, and cleaned a lot of that material out and got relatively clean criminal statute. Then we move to the current phase in which Parliament has started once again creating specific offences and other provisions to deal with specific social concerns. So we've ended up with criminal legislation more complex than it was after that phase of cleaning out what I'll call all the old stuff. Perhaps there will be a counter-trend one day, who knows, but the fact is that the law has become more complex. There's another factor which probably only the insiders are aware of, but which is a real factor, and it's what I would call the individualisation of justice. When I first entered the law, there was a general acceptance that the law, and I'm talking the civil law in particular, should basically comprise general rules which were reasonably clear. It was accepted that there would be cases in which the general rule would not or would produce an unfair result, or if you wish, wouldn't produce a fair result. But everyone accepted that was the price of a general rule to cover a multitude of cases and a rule that was clear. And so we had that saying that many of you would have heard, hard cases make bad law, meaning if you adjust the law just because the outcome seems tough, you'll be making bad law. Stick to the general rule. Parliament, and to some extent the courts themselves, have wanted judges to be able to fashion remedies and results in the individual cases that were seen as fair in each and every case. So we've moved away from the idea of saying, well, the general rule says you lose, that's tough, but you lose. So this has led to an increased emphasis in the law and in legislation on judicial discretions and to conferring powers on judges to avoid what might seem an unfair outcome from the rigid application of a general rule. I think these tendencies may have gone too far. Now, that's a big generalisation about the end result of two or three different processes. But I think the end result is that judges in the criminal area are struggling to explain the law to juries in reasonably simple terms, sentencing is becoming too complicated, and civil cases have got too complex, certainly more complex than in the past, adding to cost, which is already too high. Somehow or other, we need to start on a process of winding back or simplifying. I don't mean going back to where we were originally, but to eliminating some of the complexities. I don't suggest this is an easy task, and there is an obstacle I can see immediately in the area of the criminal law. Any government that embarks on this process of simplification in the criminal law runs the risk, I think you could say the certainty, of being accused of being soft on crime, the worst thing you could say about anyone. The accusation will be made because of necessity, existing provisions in the criminal law would have to be repealed and replaced by simpler provisions. It would be relatively easy to paint that as intended to reduce the punishment that the offenders receive. A similar problem applies in the area of the civil law. Any simplification agenda can be painted as depriving individuals of remedies that they now have. I think that in time, society will look back on the 90s and the first decade of this century as an era of increasing complexity in the law, attributable to good motives, but taken to an extreme that became counterproductive. So they are just some thoughts about, or some thoughts reflecting my view of how things stand at the moment from my side of the fence, and happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much to the Chief Justice for those thoughtful remarks. I found some encouragement in there and some common ground in our views on cameras in courts and the law and social media, although it's clear that the relationship with technology will remain a conundrum for both our industries for quite some time. As the Chief Justice said, he's happy to take questions. There's a central microphone where I'd ask you to go if you'd like to ask. And Michael, you're first.
Chief Justice, I'm Michael Owen from The Australian. Your opposition to cameras in courts appears to be based on a fear of a loss of control. I'm just wondering, why should the judiciary be the ones that decide what is in the public interest, how long clips should be shown on TV, what cases should be covered, given, as you said at the start in your address, these are public proceedings?
Well, I don't think our starting position is a fear of loss of control, first of all. But second, my point is there's a lot of work to make cameras in court work. And I don't see any point in us doing all that work for the sake of improving new film clips on the evening news. if it was a process, as I said, where the public can see substantial parts of the proceedings and can come to understand how the court really functions, then I think it's worth our while making that effort. In the end, if the government legislate that we have to have cameras in court, we have to have them. But to the extent that my views count, if the government asks me what I think, that's what I think, that it's not worth the effort and the impact on the individuals involved if all it's going to do is lead to a new angle in the news clip in the news of an evening.
Sorry, you seem to be saying that the decision about what is filmed and what is shown on TV should be one for the judiciary, and that would be easier to control with an online streaming situation. I'm just wondering why... doesn't that throw up conflicts for judges?
Well, let's say the government said they would do the streaming. I'm not saying we have to do the streaming. All I'm saying is with the technological advantages, we can do it, and now that we can do it, I can see an answer. In other words, instead of saying no cameras in courts, I can see an answer in which in a few years' time the courts might be saying we will stream the proceedings to the web so the public can see them. So I'm not saying we have to do it. All I'm saying is in the not-too-distant future we'll be recording sound and vision, and it will then become possible as part of that to stream it.
OK, so news directors and journalists will be able to decide which cases to cover and what to show on TV?
No, that doesn't follow, because we'd still have to consider what uses to be made of it.
So it is about you guys retaining control then, isn't it?
Someone needs to. Even in New Zealand, they've got rules. For instance, there are limits on when you can film the accused. You can't have the camera on him so that just at the moment when he's looking his most evil, you get a little clip and use that on the news. You can only film him, I think, in New Zealand when he pleads, guilty or not guilty, and when the verdict comes in. So, and you've got to think about all the people who are in court. I mean, let's just say a relative of yours, a female relative, is a witness in a sexual offence and she's the victim. Are we just going to say, all right, that's going to be streamed, we can't do anything about this? We've got to think about the witnesses. We don't want people to refuse to come to court because we're streaming it. So, there are a lot of things we've got to consider.
So, Candice Keller from the Advertiser newspaper. Resourcing has been an ongoing issue in the justice system, and seemingly in the last budget there were further cuts, and it's making justice a bit harder to be accessible and to deliver, I guess. What will be the impact of that, and do you feel like courts are becoming a target?
Well, we're not a target. I mean, I think they're ignoring us. That's the trouble. I wish we were a target for money. I think in the broad, our problem... I think this would be a fair summation. The government give us enough money to keep doing what we're basically doing, but in the last couple of budgets, as with government departments, there have been significant cuts, and so we've had to cut even further, and there really is no fat there. We lack the funding to enable us to give the attention we need to what I'd call innovation and change. We just don't have spare staff. We don't have a policy unit who's sitting there thinking about streaming to the web. If anything's going to be done about it, I and some other judges have to form a committee and in our spare time try to work on it. So we don't have the funding for innovation and change that I think we need, and there are a number of areas where substantial capital funding is made and the government simply won't give it to us. Our IT systems, when I was appointed in 1995, were really well in advance of systems generally, and so people came from other countries to look at our IT systems. They're still the same systems. They're way out of date. And then there's the other thing, the Supreme Court building, which, it's Victorian in its facilities, probably not even Victorian, pre-Victorian. So, as I said, in fairness to the government, they give us the funding to keep things going, but we suffer cuts, as in other public sector bodies, which make it more difficult. We don't have the funding that enables us to be as innovative as we'd like to, or at least to think about it, and there are some major capital issues for which we can't secure funding.
Thank you. Your Honour, Hannah Silverman from the Advertiser. My question is, in wake of the problems associated with the News of the World, where do you think we draw the line between the public's right to know and the general right for privacy?
Well, I really couldn't answer that question. All I'd say is I think creating a tort or a civil action for privacy, I think, is a very tricky job. It must be possible to do it because some countries have done it. But it seems to me it would be a very difficult job. But I wouldn't pretend to say where the line should be drawn. I think that's something really to be thrashed out in Parliament. It's a broad social question on which my views are no better than yours, frankly. All I'd say is we'll keep a particular eye, I suppose, as best we can on people who are coming to court. And so we'd be particularly concerned to protect them. But I don't think our view there even would be where the line's to be drawn. All we'd be saying is, well, if a person is a vulnerable witness, the fact that they're due to go to court shouldn't be exposed in the media assertion of some right to publicise. On the other hand, I don't think we'd be all that much in favour of giving that person a civil right. I think we'd say, look, it's better if the court has the ability to try to protect them rather than saying if they want protection, they've got to sue someone. But I think the real answer to your question is I can't answer it.
Thank you.
Your Honour, Steve Rice, the Advertiser. Could you please give us an insight into the relationship between the police and the courts and whether or not this could be improved?
Not a complete answer, and yes, it could be improved. I think our relations with the police are pretty good. We have to keep our... My view is we have to keep our distance to some extent from the police. You might say, well, why don't you judges get down to the police club on Friday nights and have a drink with them? Well, the answer is, if next Monday one of them is in the witness box before you, you've got a problem, particularly if you poured out to him all your current troubles. So, overall, I think the relationship with the police is good. I mean, they do a good job. There are times the courts are critical, obviously, of what they've done, and at times they're critical of us. I think at times their criticisms of sentencing has been a bit unfair because I think they really do understand what a complex job it is. And it doesn't mean they should never criticise, but I think at times they have criticised sentencing in a manner that really just reflects that simplistic view. It's all about just being tough. But overall, we have a pretty good relationship, I think, and we cooperate in many ways, particularly the Magistrates' Court, because of the high volume of police matters going through that court. There's a lot of cooperation about administrative and other arrangements between the Magistrates' Court and the police. I could just add, and I think from what I know, they do a terrific job, I think, in the youth court. I think they give excellent support to the drug court. So there are areas like that of our work where the relationship is excellent.
Just at the beginning, you said you thought it could be improved. Anything specific?
Nothing specific. It's just, again, really, if we all had more time, that we could sit down. It's one of the paradoxes of life, I think, that sometimes you haven't got time to make the improvements you need. You know need to be made because you're so busy just doing the job.
Thank you.
Your Honour, Sarah Martin from the Advertiser. I was hoping you might be able to share with us your thoughts on the government's handling of the McPherson inquiry into Burnside Council.
I'm not going to. I've given the Advertiser half an edition already. If I answered that one, this would be front page. And I'd be in deep bother.
Are you able to speak more generally then about if there are any concerns about politics interfering with natural justice?
Not generally, no. In fact, members of Parliament and others are very good at the general level. I've never heard of a member of Parliament or a minister trying to influence the outcome of a case. Just unheard of. And I think I would hear of it if it was happening. So, no, I think generally things are quite good. But obviously, when a case gets political, it takes on a new dimension. I think that's all I can say about Burnside.
OK. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Birgitta Sorensen. I'm Chair of the Board for Victim Support Service. I've been a victim of crime as well as a witness in the Supreme Court. I'm particularly interested in what you were saying about consideration of victims of crime, witnesses and also jurors in letting cameras into the courtroom. I do have family who are in media as well, so I understand the media interest in coming into a courtroom to see what's going on, but from my personal point of view, I feel there's enough opportunities for media to come into the courtroom. I was a bit concerned about the first speaker asking or saying that you might want to control what's happening in the court. Can I just remind people, a courtroom is about people. It's about very serious situations that are happening in people's life. I would like to just clarify with you, would you be supportive of not bringing the cameras into the courtroom to help protect the victims of crime, the witnesses? It's a very stressful situation, and I would think that the cameras would just increase stress for everybody.
Well, I certainly agree they do, and also they have effects on the behaviour of the judge and the lawyers. The short answer is, my view is if we were streaming proceedings, when you're deciding what to stream, the interests of victims and vulnerable witnesses require very careful consideration. So you'd probably say, well, this is a vulnerable witness case, that one won't be streamed at all, because my concept of streaming is you're trying to show people the complete case. So it's not much good if you don't show them the witness of the evidence of the alleged victim. So I think it would influence very strongly what you do stream or televise out of court.
My name's David Kerr. I'm from Victim Support Service as well. At the risk of adding to the complexity of the law, this question's more about those who are disenfranchised in our system. In particular, we'd be aware of child crime victims who don't necessarily get access to the law, and more recently the issue of people with disability who don't have the capacity to orally present their evidence to the law, to the courts. Do you have some comments about that?
Just of a general nature, I was discussing that with Terry at lunch. It is a problem. Obviously, we do need specially trained investigators to interview people with a disability and in particular young children, and people who are trained in handling those cases. On the other hand, if due to disability the alleged victim is simply incapable of giving a coherent story, at the moment I don't know what the answer is, I have to say, because it's hard to think how can you convict someone if the alleged victim can't give a coherent story. It's not to say that there aren't cases where circumstantial evidence from other sources will prove the crime, even though the victim can't say anything. I mean, many murders are a one-on-one situation. The victim is deceased, and yet often the accused is convicted based on circumstantial evidence. But that's a bit harder in this area. So the short answer is, I suppose it's a bit glib, but we need properly trained investigators. But beyond that, I'm not sure how you overcome the problem of the alleged victim who simply cannot give a coherent account of what happened.
They may be able to give a coherent account if indeed they're provided with the means to do that.
That's what I mean. If we've got to do everything we can to give them the best chance they can possibly have to tell their story. But if with all that you get to a point at which they still can't, I just don't know what you do next.
Thank you, Your Honour.
Des Ryan from In Daily, Your Honour. I actually have a follow-up. He asked my question, but I have a follow-up question in relation to that. Perhaps there's a possibility of changing how evidence is given in those cases where a child with a disability can't enunciate what happened to him or her. Maybe there is a suggestion, for example, there should be more of a inquisitorial function, such as the coroner's court, where evidence is simply presented rather than the adversarial cross-examination. Do you think there is perhaps some other model that we need to look at there?
Well, possible, but I doubt it. I'd be interested to know how in the European system they handle these cases, and the answer is I don't know how. But so what you're postulating is that someone like me then is sitting there. Now, I haven't got the training, so does that mean I'm going to have to be trained now to do this? And bearing in mind that I think in an ideal state, often it's trained psychologists who do this, so do I go off and do a psychology degree? So dropping the problem onto the bench of the courtroom isn't necessarily the answer, I think. The real problem is, in one way or another, how do you get the story out? And again, my understanding of the European system is that it does allow the defence to test the prosecution case, so it seems impossible to eliminate that aspect. So if that's going to happen, and the child, if it's a child, simply can't answer questions to test, you know, designed to test the case, I don't quite know where you go there in terms of the rights of the accused. So it is a very complex problem. I think we'll hope a solution can be found.
Graham Hunter, Your Honour, from Seven News. Your Honour, how many millions do you need to meet the IT challenge you've discussed? How many millions to meet the capital works needs of the court buildings? How would you prioritise those needs? And how would you rate your chances of getting the cash for either?
So this is tomorrow's front page.
Well, in very broad terms, look, I'm not too good on all these figures. My hunch is for a new IT system, we'd need, my hunch is 5 to 10 million. We are a big IT system as it is. That's just a guess. If you want a better figure, and I think you should get a better one, Gary Thompson, the administrator, is here, Graham. He's about 2 metres from you at the moment. To redevelop the Supreme Court site, the square, Gouger Street, Mill Street, Wright Street, King William Street, that whole block, we own the whole of that. I think you'd be looking at 100-odd million to redo that. So that's the main building. IT, what was the other one?
How would you prioritise those two needs, IT as against capital works?
I'd probably have to say IT first, simply because it's conceivable the government could find 5 to 10 million. At the moment, with things that are happening, it doesn't seem conceivable that they're going to find 100+ million. So simply on the basis of pragmatics, if the money's there for the IT, I'd go for it.
And your assessment of the chances of getting that cash?
Zero at the moment, because we've just been through the budget cycle. The attorney is very supportive. I want to make that clear. He supports us. He understands the need. So it's zero at the moment, but I suppose, Graham, every day is a new day, isn't it?
Thank you.
That's a Sphinx-like answer. But yes, ask Gary. It's all yours, Gary.
I'll come and see you in a second.
Thank you very much to the Chief Justice. You have two more functions before
we've got one left.
Let you go. I'm sorry, we're finished.
Are you sure? Because yes, it's just a plebeian asking a question.
Well, I'll answer it afterwards if you like.
Thank you.
Personally.
Two more functions for the Chief Justice. One is to select a winner of the raffle. I'm sure this will be the most impartial judgment we've had in this this function. And I don't think you bought a ticket, are you?
Purple B3. Tchaikovsky, is it?
What's it say? Tchaikovsky or Tchaikovsky or something like that? Tchaikovsky. Okay. Is somebody coming up? I think there is some kind of prize here for him. A Jeff Timms voucher. Congratulations. And finally, we thank the Chief Justice and ask him to take away some good South Australian red wine with him by way of thanks. Please thank the Chief Justice, John Gillard. Oh, 3 more prizes. Deanna, come and be my... I'm sorry, there are prizes of beer and wine. We have to pick 3 more tickets. Deanna's going to do the honours. So this is red F14, which appears to have the initials BR on it. No? That was either pain or a winner. Do the next one, dear. Yeah, let's keep it moving. So, and the next one is purple B21, Barb Adams.
She didn't get to ask a question, but she gets a prize. And one more. So. And the final one is Black F58. Now, my final task is to let you know that the next two Press Club luncheons are with Christine Nixon on Monday, August 15, and with Andrew Robb on Wednesday, September 7. If you would like to book or have your name added to the email list, please speak to Joanna. Thanks very much for your attendance today.